This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww. Yes?
Chris, it's me, Jonathan.
What do you want?
We can start recording in person again. COVID is over. I licked several doorknobs on the way over here just to be sure.
Oh no, I'm not falling for that again. You said that last summer, and look what happened.
It's for real this time. COVID is over. No one is practicing even the slightest bit of self-restraint when it comes to public gatherings anymore. It's like George W. Bush said in 2003 on the deck of that aircraft carrier. Mission accomplished.
Right, but you remember what happened after that, right?
No. It's going to be okay now. We have vaccines. As long as we reach that 75% threshold that all those experts are being quoted as saying in the newspapers.
But you realize that governments just picked that number arbitrarily, right? There's no scientific basis for it.
Well, regardless, this summer will be better than last summer. People are going to learn from the mistakes of the past, just like they did during Anyway, don't worry, it's gonna be fine.
Okay, hold on. Let me just disable some of the booby traps. Okay, only step on the tiles that have red dots on them.
Okay. Okay. All right. I'll just set up.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. I really got into the show Arrow during the pandemic, and I figured my condo could use more Arrow-based booby traps.
That almost killed me.
So did the show. So what are we talking about this month?
Well, what better way to celebrate the end of the most deadly pandemic in a century than by discussing a disease that people can't even agree exists?
Oh no.
Yep, we're discussing fibromyalgia. Suit up. It's going to get esoteric. It's a show about medicine.
With 20% more fiber.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is
called... Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence, coming to you live, but pre-recorded, from our recording studios in Chris's dining room, because, after careful consideration, the risk of recording in person seems low enough now that we can return to our regular activities without fear of an impending apocalypse.
You poor, deluded fool.
That voice of constant pessimism and of, kids, be careful, the pandemic is not over on the 6 o'clock newscast, is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and man who remains convinced that humanity is doomed.
Watch the news.
That you're constantly on, saying, guys, listen to me, be careful now as we reopen, be careful. Remember the 5th of November or some other obscure historical reference you like to make all the time.
And sitting to my left for the first time in a long time is my co-host Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who doesn't understand that I ask him to sit 6 feet away from me precisely because I care.
Your concern is touching.
I know.
Well, today we are discussing fibromyalgia, which sounds like the name of the ill-fated heroine in an old Italian giallo movie. Fibromyalgia, a disease that... many people don't think is actually a disease.
Yeah, it's very controversial. I was reading one article that described it as living in the gray zone between medicine and psychology.
And at least in recent years, the diagnosis of fibromyalgia has become very common.
Yeah, between 2 and 5% of the population.
Wow, yeah, that seems suspiciously high. 5%, that's 1 in every 20 people.
And yet, there are people who say that the true prevalence is underdiagnosed, that when you apply the standard diagnostic criteria, many people meet the definition of fibromyalgia and are not given the diagnosis.
So what are the diagnostic criteria? How do you diagnose fibromyalgia?
Well, so it's a clinical diagnosis.
Meaning a doctor diagnoses you, but there's no test to help make this diagnosis.
Right. There's no lab test, no x-ray, no scan, no physical exam finding other than the pain.
So it's a disease where all the tests come back normal.
Yeah.
Given this information, I'm a little bit skeptical.
I would expect nothing less.
So what's going on here then? What causes fibromyalgia?
Well, there's no single cause. It's part genetic predisposition, part environmental trigger, and part dysregulation of the central nervous system that, you know, disrupts how patients experience pain.
What do you mean, experience pain?
Well, pain is complicated.
No, it isn't. See? Straightforward. Now that we're recording in person, I can do that again.
So, ow. But no, when you get hit or get bumped or injure yourself, your nerve endings send the signal back to the brain, and your brain has to process that information. So the same stimulus can be perceived as more or less painful, or not painful at all, depending on the situation. And the current working theory is that fibromyalgia is a disorder of pain regulation.
But there's nothing objective that you can measure.
No, there really isn't.
So, to play skeptic's advocate, where do we draw the line between it being a physical disease and a psychological disease if there's no objective abnormality that you can measure?
Well, remember that there's no objective abnormality in people with depression. There are biochemical changes in the brain. We see that in research, but there's nothing you can point to on testing. You diagnose depression clinically, and you diagnose fibromyalgia clinically.
Speaking of depression, isn't there a lot of overlap between those two conditions?
There is. There's a lot of overlapping diseases here. Patients with fibromyalgia often also get diagnosed with things like irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, sleep problems, migraines, depression. Actually, depression is quite common. About 25% of people with fibromyalgia also have depression, and 50%, so half of those people, will go on to develop depression at some point in their lifetime.
So is fibromyalgia a separate disease, or is it just the manifestation of all these other disorders? Because, you know, people with major depression do also have pain.
Yes, that's true. And there's a lot of overlap, and it's part of what makes it such a controversial topic and so tricky a diagnosis.
So it's hard to diagnose.
It is, mainly because you have to rely exclusively on the patient history and the symptoms, like, you know, the pain, the fatigue, the irritability, the lack of energy, all those things, you know, they can be very nonspecific.
That's why it's so important for patients to take charge of their own health and listen to their bodies. That's why I love my Aura ring. Our sponsor, Aura, makes accessing information on your health. What the... Did you think that was funny, slipping that in there?
A little, yeah. You got Ron Brigandied.
Our ring is not one of our sponsors.
Right, because we have ethics, but not money.
Exactly. Okay, we'll take a short break for an actual sponsorship, I guess. And when we come back, we'll address the issue of whether diagnosing people with fibromyalgia actually helps.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you in part by Jimmy Woo's all-new homeopathic perfume, Eau de Rien. The first law of homeopathy is that like cures like, so if you want to get rid of your BO, you need to spray yourself with BO. And Jimmy Woo went looking for the most potent BO he could find. He dumped a truck full of eviscerated mackerel into a sauna frequented by triathletes after their workouts, and after a 3-week incubation, he collected one drop of the pungent secretion off the floor. That drop went into 99 drops of water, and one drop of that went into 99 drops of water, and drops of water, and one drop of that went into 99 drops of water, 99 drops of water, and one drop of that went into 99 drops of water, and one drop of that went into 99 drops of water. Eau de Rien by Jimmy Woo. If the whole thing smells fishy, It's all in your head, because those mackerel are long gone, buddy.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome back to the show. Today, we are talking about fibromyalgia and deliberately not endorsing any product on the show.
For now.
No, never. You can't get unbiased advice from someone selling you a product, is something that I've heard someone say recently.
But what about...
I know. We can't control what other people say on their podcasts. We can only control our small portion of the internet and content ourselves with the fact that self-respect and personal integrity are worth more than sponsorship deals.
Did we ever vote on that or...
Never mind. Anyway, before the break, we were talking about the diagnosis of fibromyalgia and how it's a morass of overlapping pain syndromes and concurrent diagnoses.
I don't think I ever said morass.
I'm expanding your vocabulary. But what are those famous diagnostic criteria?
Well, those have changed. Okay, so people familiar with the diagnosis may be aware of the concept of tender points. In the 1990 ACR classification criteria, there were 18 tender points. For example, the middle of the shoulder blade, on the side of the elbow, the bony prominence of your hip. And so you had to probe each of these points. And if 11 out of 18 points were tender when you palpated them, then that was a diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Was that easy to do in clinic, like probing the patient and asking, does this hurt? How about this?
So no, it was actually wildly impractical. And the idea of tender points has actually been retired. And now the 2010 criteria use a simplified diagnostic criterion, and they measure something called the widespread pain index. The body is divided into 19 regions: shoulder, upper arm, lower arm, hip, upper leg, lower leg, jaw, chest, abdomen, upper back, lower back, and neck.
And these regions are reflected on the sole of the feet, and that's what we call reflexology.
No. Okay, so you have these regions, then you measure the symptom severity score, and you ask the patient about the severity of their fatigue, and whether they wake up unrefreshed from sleep, and whether they have cognitive symptoms, so symptoms related, you know, to their thinking, and whether they have somatic symptoms, meaning of the body, like dry mouth, abdominal cramps, ringing in their ears, vomiting, heartburn, dry eyes.
I feel like those are very common complaints.
I mean, they are. But so you get a score of 0 to 3 on each of those four questions.
Hold on, let me get my calculator with the roll of paper attached to it. Let's do this properly.
Okay. So look, you get the widespread, if you have a widespread pain index score that's 7 or more, and the symptom severity score is 5 or more, or if the widespread index score is between 3 and 6, and the symptom severity score is 9 or more, then that qualifies as fibromyalgia.
What happens if you didn't take calculus in high school and you need to calculate this?
Okay, but then
there's more? This is worse than those sports stats during baseball games.
So you have to have all of those symptoms present, and they have to be present at that intensity for at least 3 months, and there has to be no alternative diagnosis.
That is the most complicated thing I've ever heard, and I studied the Krebs cycle.
I mean, look, the diagnostic criteria are a bit cumbersome, yeah.
So I have two questions.
All right.
First off, what tragic event in your past scarred you and left you the damaged husk of a man I see before me?
What's your second question?
Given the diagnosis is so complicated, how accurate are physicians at making it?
Not great, actually. There was a 2019 study where they compared physician diagnosis with the official diagnostic criteria, and it was not great. The two did not agree over half the time.
And the other part that strikes me as complicated is the fact that there has to be no alternative diagnosis.
Right.
So it's a diagnosis of exclusion then. You have to rule out everything else before you can say that someone has fibromyalgia.
Well, sort of. It's not strictly speaking a diagnosis of exclusion. And when you read guideline documents on this, recommendations are to specifically avoid fishing expeditions.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of fishing expeditions either, not after that deep sea fishing trip we took. I had to poop in a bucket, Chris. A bucket.
Look, we were both scarred by that experience. But anyway, the issue is you shouldn't take a potential fibromyalgia diagnosis as a license to start ordering every test under the sun. You have to use some degree of clinical judgment, but with a careful history and some testing, you should be able to exclude other causes for the patient's symptoms.
So these would be things like arthritis or...
Yeah, exactly. Arthritis or conditions like polymyalgia rheumatica or polymyositis or lupus.
It's never lupus. You have that on a t-shirt.
Well, sometimes it's lupus. But anyway, the pattern of symptoms is different. So, for example, with polymyalgia rheumatica, you get muscle pain, but only in large muscles like the upper arms and legs. You wouldn't get it everywhere like with fibromyalgia. And if you had polymyositis, you would have decreased muscle strength, whereas your muscle strength shouldn't change with fibromyalgia.
So you have to have a starting suspicion. It's not just run 20 tests and if everything is negative, then you get labeled with fibromyalgia.
No. Now you do have to exclude non-rheumatological things like anemia or hypothyroidism because those can cause, you know, the same symptoms. And patients can, you know, have anything when they walk into your office.
It's unfortunate that patients don't come with multiple choice answers attached in order to make things easier.
I know, right? We kept saying that in medical school all the time.
But is there something specific you can do that will tell you clearly that this is or is not fibromyalgia?
Well, one of the most important single tests would be something like ESR, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or now most people use CRP, C-reactive protein. These are inflammatory markers, and they are elevated in autoimmune conditions, and honestly, in many other diseases too, so they can be a little nonspecific. But the important point is that they are normal in fibromyalgia, because fibromyalgia is not an autoimmune or inflammatory condition.
So if the CRP test, for C-reactive protein test, was abnormal, that would mean something is also going on. It might be an autoimmune arthritis, for example, that is causing the patient's pain.
Yes.
Now, there was something that came to my attention recently, and it was a test called FMA, capital F, capital M, slash small a. There was a blog post about this on Science-Based Medicine and a blog post on the American Association of Family Physicians website that were essentially making the same point.
Right. This FMA test is essentially a cytokine assay.
Right. Cytokines being a broad catch-all term for small molecules involved in cell signaling.
Right. So what this test is doing is measuring four cytokines and using the various cytokine levels to differentiate between people with fibromyalgia and healthy controls.
So that's interesting because that would suggest that there was an organic cause for fibromyalgia, something in the body that can be measured as being abnormal.
Except it doesn't perform that well, at least not in clinically useful situations. The test accuracy is 93% sensitivity and 89% specificity.
Maybe just remind people what sensitivity and specificity mean, even though after a year and a half of COVID-19 diagnostic tests, these terms sound more familiar than they did in the before times.
Right. So sensitivity is what percentage of people who have the disease test positive, and specificity is what percentage of people without the disease test negative.
Right. And it's in the names. How sensitive is your test at picking up the people who have the disease? And how specific is it? Meaning that if you don't have the disease, you won't trigger a positive result. Now, the numbers you mentioned, 93% and 89%, they look really good, actually, in terms of sensitivity and specificity.
Yes, but they were comparing fibromyalgia patients to normal healthy controls. When you compare fibromyalgia patients to patients with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, it performs less well. The specificity drops to 70%, so basically more false positives.
And that's a more relevant everyday clinical situation, right?
Right, because we're not going around drawing blood on healthy people who feel fine to diagnose them with fibromyalgia.
Because by definition, if they feel fine, they don't have fibromyalgia.
Right. You would want to test for when somebody comes into your office with chronic pain, and you want to see if it's fibromyalgia or something like lupus.
It's never lupus.
Well, sometimes it is. But the point is, that's when you need a test to sort out the diagnosis.
And using a CRP blood test would be a more useful test in that context.
Yes, and it costs a lot less than FMA.
How much does the FMA test cost?
Over $1,000.
Holy medical mackerel! I could think of better ways of spending $1,000.
A puppy?
Yes, a single puppy, because this is how much it costs to get a dog these days. Thank you, COVID, for ruining that too.
I'm confident prices will drop shortly. I'll keep you posted.
Now, I'm still a bit on the fence about whether fibromyalgia is a distinct disease or just an atypical manifestation of pre-existing diseases like depression. But philosophical considerations aside, the real question is, can we treat it? And does giving people a diagnosis actually do any good, as you would expect that it would?
So what's interesting is that most people think that fibromyalgia is over-medicalized.
I guess because you're giving people a disease label, which turns them from somebody with a complaint into a patient with a disease to whom pharmaceutical solutions can be proposed.
Sure, and that is a justifiable concern. But what's interesting is that when you look at the data, giving people a diagnosis of fibromyalgia seems to decrease healthcare spending. There were some British researchers that looked at 2,260 patients diagnosed with fibromyalgia and compared their healthcare utilization to control subjects. And in the 10 years before they received their diagnosis, the fibromyalgia patients had 25 versus 12 doctor visits per year and got 11 versus 4.5 prescriptions per year.
So even before they get this label applied to them, they are going to more doctors and getting more prescriptions.
Right. So it's not the diagnosis that uses more healthcare resources. It's the persistent symptoms. And what's fascinating is that after they got a diagnosis, healthcare costs dropped.
So the idea is that you give them a diagnosis and now they're no longer going to different doctors getting all kinds of tests and x-rays and unproven cytokine assays that cost $1,000.
Exactly. I mean, the cost savings are not huge, but the reduction in testing means that you save about £60. These were British studies, remember? So £60 per patient per 6 months.
What if I distrust the British for arbitrary reasons, and I want U.S. data. America number one.
So we have that too. U.S. research also shows a cost saving. They actually found a greater cost savings, incidentally, over $1,000 in the 3 months post-diagnosis, and also improved quality of life.
I'm obligated to say that I am somewhat suspicious that quality of life will improve, but that's just so you can tell me a story.
Well, let me tell you a story.
I somehow knew you were going to say that. And also, remember what we talked about.
I know. Stories about how I thought I saw a celebrity on the street are not interesting to other people. But actually, what I was going to say is that I get referred a lot of people with chest pain.
Well, stands to reason.
Yeah. Now, statistically, most of them do not have heart disease, but they have pain. And invariably, once they do the stress test and it comes back normal, the pain goes away.
But doesn't that just reinforce the idea that many diseases, like fibromyalgia, might be psychological? If reassurance and removing stress, you know, improves your condition.
Well, true, but stress reduction has benefits even with something like blood pressure control. I mean, that doesn't invalidate blood pressure as a physiological concept.
Okay, so knowing what it is and what it is not can be reassuring and help take care of some of the psychological stress-related pain and anxiety. I get that. I guess the real question is, can you treat fibromyalgia? Because if patients have symptoms and you have a clear treatment, then whether or not it's a distinct organic disease or the physical manifestation of a psychological problem is a bit of a philosophical argument.
Right. So there are treatments, and the main one is tricyclic antidepressants, or TCAs. Like, for example, amitriptyline. Other types of antidepressants, like SNRIs, are used too, and some anti-seizure medications, like pregabalin or gabapentin.
That's a pretty diverse group of medications.
Well, they have their primary function as depression or seizure medications, but they are also commonly used to treat chronic pain, especially neuropathic pain, meaning pain that comes from a part of the nervous system.
So my question then is, if you're treating fibromyalgia with an antidepressant, are you treating the depression or changing the brain's biochemistry to affect the pain signals?
I mean, probably a bit of both. It's very difficult to tease out the fibromyalgia from the associated conditions like depression or the sleep problems.
All right. Does anything else help with fibromyalgia?
Well, lifestyle changes and exercise. There was actually a Cochrane review on this, and lifestyle changes, especially aerobic exercise, do seem to help improve quality of life. They didn't change pain scores all that much, and the long-term benefits are somewhat muted, but patient-reported quality of life does seem to improve.
hard to argue with exercise being good for you, an all-around fair suggestion if you are in a condition that allows you to exercise.
Right, and a big thing is patient education. Telling people their symptoms are not dangerous, not due to any other underlying illness, and not something that requires a lot of testing, that's important. It's also not going to worsen over time or lead to progressive disability.
Do people ever get cured?
So no. I mean, most people have symptoms lifelong.
That's somewhat depressing.
Well, chronic pain is hard to treat, but you can make it a bit better.
So can we say that fibromyalgia is a real disease or not?
Well, to some extent, maybe it doesn't matter because the pain is real. So treat the pain.
The pain is real, so treat the pain.
The pain is real, so treat the pain.
The pain is real, so treat the pain. The pain is real, so treat the pain. The pain is real, so treat the pain. The pain is real, so treat the pain. The pain is real, so treat the pain. The pain is real, so treat the pain.
When we come back, can you mix and match different COVID vaccines from dose 1 to dose 2? The answer used to be an educated guess. Now, there's data from a randomized controlled trial. We'll look at what the data have to say after the break.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you in part by an all-new movie from Hulu Flix Plus. They thought they could science their way out of COVID-19.
Oh my God, you're experimenting on sharks?
Not just any sharks, Creatina. These are genetically modified sharks.
Yes. The serum is almost ready. Soon, this coronavirus will be history.
But when scientists play God, all hell breaks loose.
Guys, I'm getting a headache and starting to feel autistic. What did you do?
She's showing signs of stomach cancer. And prostate cancer.
That's impossible. How did you modify these sharks, Tom?
I used glyphosate.
It's the sequel you've been waiting for, and the organic food lobby is footing the bill and writing the script. Academy Award nominee Terry Pratenfall.
It's in my urine. The glyphosate is in my urine and a shark is biting on my foot.
MTV Music Award nominee Shenron Double Dippin'.
The sharks. They can create tornadoes because of the glyphosate genetic modifications.
And YouTube Streamer Award for Best Prank Video Runner-Up, Don Pete III.
Hello, Cool J tried to warn us.
Deep Blue Sharknado 9, Electric Glyphosate Boogaloo. Because with everyone staying at home these days, we're gonna need more movies.
Welcome back to The Body of Evidence. It's been a long one, long pause. So can you get Pfizer's RNA-based COVID vaccine as dose 2 if you got AstraZeneca for dose 1? What about the reverse? And what does it mean regarding safety and efficacy? We have data from the United Kingdom. Now, this is a preprint, so it has not been formally reviewed by other scientists. It has not, at the time of recording anyway, been accepted for publication in any academic journal. But with that out of the way, these are the results from the COM-COV trial, COM-COV trial, in which participants were blinded as to which vaccine they were receiving. What did the scientists do?
Science.
And that's the end of our block. Mm. When we come back...
So the COM-COV trial, if you are not aware of it, this is actually two trials. So there's COM-COV 1 and COM-COV 2. So this is COM-COV 1. What they basically had was they had four groups. So there were people who got AstraZeneca. There were people who got AstraZeneca-Pfizer, people who got Pfizer-AstraZeneca, and Pfizer-Pfizer. Mm-hmm. So two groups were homologous groups. They got the same dose. Two groups were heterologous groups. They got different vaccines. There is going to be another study, COMCOV-2, that is currently ongoing that looked at stuff beyond AstraZeneca and Pfizer. There's Moderna in the mix. I think Novavax is in there too. Johnson & Johnson isn't because it's a single dose vaccine. So they wanted two doses vaccines. Right. So there is more for people who are going to who are asking about, well, what about Moderna? Where does that fit in? It's in the works. The reason why it was done this way is because this is a UK study. And what were the first two vaccines available in the UK? I mean, Pfizer was the first available everywhere.
Right.
And AstraZeneca, because it was made
Oxford University.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So that's why they did it.
Okay.
And so what they did was, a lot of these people had gotten their first dose, and they said, if you've gotten your first dose, volunteer for the study, and then we'll randomize you to whether you get a second dose that is the same or different.
I see.
You will probably have heard of COMCOV study because a month ago, they released their preliminary results about the side effects.
Mm-hmm. And this made the news.
This made the news. And what they reported was that there were more side effects if you had a different second dose. So the mix and match strategy, more fever, more muscle aches. And so, I mean, mild side effects.
Right.
But
these are not concerning.
No.
And they're temporary.
No, they're. But people interpreted them in a positive way because they said if you're having more of a fever, more muscle aches, you're having more of these immunogenic or reactive side effects, it might mean that you have a more robust immune response.
Now, I will say that I have looked into this, and there was a review of that idea, which is commonly referred to as no pain, no gain.
Yeah.
There you go, no pain, no gain. The review of this about 2 years ago basically concluded that there's some evidence one way, some evidence the other way. Yeah. We don't know if that's a fact or not. And I've seen some immunologists being quoted very recently saying, yes, if you get a strong immune reaction, it means the vaccine is working. And I'm like, we don't know that for a fact.
No. I mean, I think it's a way of I think that's true. I'm not sure that the converse is true. Mm-hmm. So if you did get a lot of side effects and you had a very strong inflammatory response, it probably does mean that you had a big immune response. But if you didn't get any side effects, it doesn't mean you didn't get an immune response.
Right. Okay.
So, I mean, but it's hard to say. And I mean, like, I had my vaccine and I had virtually no side effects.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we're the good ones.
We're the good ones. Although a friend of mine, I was talking to him the other day, he got his second dose and his entire left side of his neck and arm were swollen. At one point, he checked his underarm. He had like a tennis ball in his underarm.
Wow.
Like, he had a swollen lymph node.
Wow.
And there were issues, actually. A bit of a sidetrack. It's not digressions, but it's a small digression. There was an issue for a while of women getting the vaccine and then feeling like a lymph node in their arm. And thinking they had breast cancer.
Right.
And then they were going for mammograms and they would see some lymph, small vascular changes. They'd be like, oh, well, maybe we should do more testing. So a lot of these women were sent for further testing, not realizing that it was all just a short-term consequence of the vaccine. So some people get reactions, some people don't. We don't really know what it means.
Right.
But anyway, so...
So those were preliminary results. Now we have the final results. And so what was found with regards to safety of these four protocols? Pfizer, AstraZeneca, AstraZeneca, or mix and match, one way or the other?
No real safety concerns. Again, the increased side effects. So this was still the same study. They just released it in parts. You know, as the joke sometimes goes, it's slicing the salami thin.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So why produce one large paper when you can get two publications out of it?
And also because, it's such an urgent, developing situation. You want to get any kind of preliminary results you have out there for better or for worse.
Yeah. But it didn't look like there were any safety concerns. And that's why most people now, and have been saying so for a while, that you probably can just get your vaccine wherever. It doesn't matter. Even though AstraZeneca and the mRNA vaccines have different mechanism of actions, they are, to a certain extent, doing the same thing, which is delivering the genetic code of the virus to your cells so you can make the spike protein.
Either in RNA form or in DNA form.
Yeah, so the final common pathway is the same.
Yeah.
So it's not, in retrospect, not entirely surprising that they would be interchangeable in this way, which begs the question then, why are you getting a more robust immune response? Which I guess is the next one we're going to talk about, which is what were the results?
Because the immune system is where intuition goes to die, as Ed Yong wrote for The Atlantic like a year ago.
Yeah.
Which is a great quote. I was never a fan of the immune system. I wish, okay, here's my digression here before we get to do data on efficacy, which is that the immune system, when it's been labeled by scientists, all the different cells and all that kind of stuff, there's such a lack of imagination. Mm. Like cells have, you know, it's usually like it's B cells and T cells, and okay, there's like macrophages, and then it's like, what are the numbers again? At the top of like T cells, you've got
T helper cells, T helper cell one, T helper cell two.
No, they're positive for this number and that number and that number. Like CDR, yeah, the complements.
Oh yeah.
CD45 positive, CD8 negative. How do you remember this stuff?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, credit to the physicists who are like, we found different flavors of quarks, and we're going to call this one charm quark,
because
it's charming. And this one is a top quark, and this is a bottom quark, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And physics is fun.
Yeah.
And immunology is like, no, give the next number in line, 108.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, that being said, they do have natural killer cells.
They do, which is a cool name.
Yeah.
Okay, so... finally, what about efficacy in this trial for the mix and match strategy? At least efficacy as determined by the amount of antibodies against the spike protein detected in the blood.
Right. And that's the important point. The study did not look at infection rates. They did not look at whether people were less likely to get COVID. And I suspect that if they had, they would not have seen a difference, because there is something in epidemiology called a ceiling effect or a floor effect, depending on whether you're the upper or lower bound of something. But if nobody in your sample gets the disease, it's very hard to prove a benefit.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why the COVID studies went so quickly is you saw a separation of the curves very, very quick, because everybody in the placebo group got COVID. So you see the difference very easily. But if when you're talking about two groups of fully immunized people, most of whom are not getting sick, there's probably not going to be a major difference in infection rates, and small percentage-wide differences wouldn't be
noticeable.
We'd have
to follow them for like 10 years, Chris. Yeah. And then we would know.
But what they did show was that the group who got different vaccines, in particular the ones who got AstraZeneca, Pfizer, had higher antibody levels. So take that for what you will. It may be a little bit better. Does that actually translate into an improvement of clinical infection? Unclear, but there might be an advantage. And so going forward, not really going to be relevant to us in North America, because most of us now are vaccinated, except for the loyal few who will fight the resistance forever. Mm-hmm. But as we roll out these vaccines to other countries, there may be an advantage to a mix and match strategy. But also, and more importantly, it's going to give vaccine programs more flexibility, because you don't have to rely on a single manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Why it would be different or better, we don't really know. But
because the immune system is where intuition goes to
die. Yeah.
When we come back, an update on whether or not the RNA-based COVID vaccines will give you myo or pericarditis, and just how worried you should or shouldn't be. That's after the break. Do you have a question about a study you saw or a headline you read? Is your aunt sending you misinformation on WhatsApp? You can email us at thebodyofevidence@gmail.com. If you want to contribute to our show, head over to patreon.com/thebodyofevidence. For as low as $1 a month, you will gain access to a bonus audio segment each month, and you will help us grow and increase the quality of our work. Welcome back to the final stretch of The Body of Evidence. Last month, we ended the show by mentioning a potential COVID vaccine-related side effect that had just been flagged, which was the potential, again, for the RNA-based vaccines, those of Pfizer and of Moderna, to cause either an inflammation of the heart muscle or an inflammation of the outer lining of the heart in a very small number of people. How has the situation evolved in the last month?
Well, so there's been a series of meetings and reports. A series might be putting it strongly. I think there's been two in the past month. One of them was canceled for the Juneteenth holiday in the U.S., mm-hmm. and everyone lost their minds.
How dare there How be dare a new you? Holiday?
They're like, our children are dying. How can you take a day off? And it was like, tone it down. The end of the Civil War was a pretty big deal.
Yes.
And most people don't understand that emergency meeting just means not pre-planned. Mm-hmm. So everyone cool it. So
what next? Are we going to have a holiday for the Native Americans?
Yeah. Not in Quebec, we won't, because the premier said no.
Yeah.
Anyway. But yes. So a series of meetings were had to look at this issue of myocarditis, pericarditis. And to remind people, myocarditis and pericarditis, anything that ends in itis means inflammation. So pericarditis.
Or infection.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. I mean, that's a misnomer.
That's what you told me.
Well, it's a bit of, we use it that way, but it's a bit of a misnomer.
Right.
We do use the term itis to refer to an infection, like a cholecystitis, let's say, infection of the gallbladder. But that's not right, because the term itis means inflammation.
So I was right. Thank you.
Yeah. So, but we use it clinically to mean, anyways. Right. But the point is, when
doctors
we talk about,
are stupid.
Yeah. When we talk about, well, it's
no, a lot of stupid.
A lot of it has to do with the historicity of where these names come from, right? And when people before people knew a germ knew what the germ theory of disease was about, they'd be like, "Oh, this is a very inflamed appendix."
Right.
What's causing it? Evil humors. Yes. You know. So a lot
Did
of
you have premarital sex? Yeah. Well, there you go. There That's you why go. You have appendicitis.
There you go. So pericarditis, myocarditis. Pericarditis means inflammation of the tissue around the heart.
Peri around the perimeter.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. The heart. Yeah. Well, pericardium. So the tissue around the heart is called the pericardium. So it's called pericarditis. Myocarditis means inflammation of the heart muscle itself. Myo meaning muscle.
Yeah.
Could be caused by many different things. Occasionally an infection. Well, actually, I shouldn't say occasional infection. Most often, it's an infection. It's usually a viral infection that causes the inflammation. We usually never find the trace
like
of the
COVID.
Well, COVID, yeah, yeah. And there were, so COVID heart. Small digression.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few reports about COVID causing damage to the heart,
right?
Which is not inconceivable. And I have at least one patient who probably has that. Got sick in March of 2020 with a very severe viral illness, and then suffered heart damage. We couldn't prove it was COVID because there was no testing back then. So potentially, but it doesn't damage the heart that often. But the idea of COVID heart was then aggressively debunked by a group of people who I think took the initial case reports perhaps much more seriously than was initially intended.
Because I remember hearing that, oh, maybe COVID is actually a disease of the blood vessels.
Yeah, well, yeah, people said that. That was unfortunate. No, it's very clearly a respiratory pathogen. It can cause blood clots, and it can cause strokes, and it caused, I mean, if you remember Nick Cordero, right, the Broadway actor in the U.S., the young guy who's in the ICU, had his legs amputated, and, like, it can cause some very severe coagulopathies, no question. But to say it was a disease of the blood vessels was maybe taking it a bit far.
Right.
Anyways, all this to say, inflammation of the heart and the tissue around the heart, it can happen. It can happen for a bunch of different reasons, usually infections, viral infections. And so people started observing these an increased number of cases after vaccination. And so this is what the CDC and the ACIP, the I forget what ACIP stands for now. I've completely blanked on their name. Immunization practice. I forget what the AC is, though. I'm just going to Google.
So obviously, if it happens,
Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Sorry.
Okay. Almost kind of like NASI.
Yeah. So they're a subgroup of the CDC.
Right. So just because it happens after vaccination does not mean it was caused by the vaccines. No. You have to look to see if there were more cases than expected. And so that's what's been looked at.
That's right. And so they looked at the number of cases that were reported to two sources. And we'll talk about this. So they looked at VARS and the vaccine.
You're so well prepared for this.
I wrote an article.
And I'm the one on vacation.
I wrote an article about this. The VAC, it's, no, not VSD.
VCAP?
No, it's VSD. It's not Vaccine Data Link.
Safety Database. Vaccine Safety Database.
Vaccine Safety Data. Hold on. I'm going to look up the article I wrote in the Gazette. I wrote an article about this. And I'm very upset with myself.
So for people who don't know, so VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, is a database that is essentially co-managed by the CDC and the FDA. And anybody, including, you know, regular people, can go in and say, I got the vaccine, I got turned into the Hulk.
Right.
So you can't take those reports at face value, but the experts of the CDC and the FDA, they do monitor this to see if there's an interesting safety signal that might be emerging from that. And they do these deep dives, they do more investigations into this. And so that's how you can find very rare events. You can't just take it at face value, but if you know what you're doing, you can do something interesting with the VAERS database.
That's right. Now there's a second database that they can look at, and it is called VSD, which it was throwing me off because VSD in cardiology also means ventricular septal defect.
Okay.
But it's called the Vaccine Safety Data Link.
Data link. Okay, yeah. I was off by half of a word.
The link was throwing me off. So like, there's no L in there. But anyways, so what this is hospital data. So what they actually have is they have an agreement with 9 hospital systems. Let me look up the exact number. It uses electronic health data compiled from 9 healthcare systems across the U.S. So like, you know, these healthcare networks like Kaiser Permanente and all that? Yeah. So they take the data from 9 of those systems from across the U.S.
And they release it publicly for anyone to look at.
No, they don't. They analyze the data. Right. But it is generally considered to be a slightly more reliable data source than VAERS, because VAERS is self-reported.
First of all, it's pronounced VAERS.
VAERS.
And second of all, yes, exactly. It's self-reported, whereas with the Kaiser Permanente or whatever, it's a doctor who's actually entering
things. Yeah, and there's
things
tests and there's records. So they've looked at both of these, and there do seem to be more cases of myocarditis, pericarditis than would be expected.
How much more?
A little bit. Okay. A little bit. We'll get to the numbers in a second. Mm-hmm. The one caveat you have to remember, though, is that when you're trying to calculate the expected number of cases, you have to realize that most cases of pericarditis, myocarditis go undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because usually people are fine, and they're usually young, healthy people, and they're like, oh, I've got some chest pain. Let me see if this goes away in a few days. Let me take some Advil. And it goes away. And they're like, all right, problem solved. So most people will not seek medical attention.
Right. So it's underdiagnosed to begin with.
So the expected number that's quoted, and when you look at the data that the estimates they use, there's such a wide range there. So you're like,
But wouldn't it also be underreported after vaccination? Or are people seeking treatment because it's after the vaccine and they're like, all hands on deck, there's something wrong, let's go get it checked out?
Exactly.
Okay.
So the at least the theory, or what I would propose to you, is that people are seeking out medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
They have a much lower threshold for seeking out medical attention.
Right, because it's after the vaccine, they're worried, and so they're wanting to get it checked out.
Okay. Exactly. So,
it's possible that the levels are not elevated.
It's possible. I think most people are willing now to concede that there may be a link. And I think the CDC finally said that the link was likely or something to that effect.
Okay.
They used the word, suggesting that it is probably that there's a likely link.
I see.
And that was the strongest wording yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still somewhat unproven because you don't know if most cases go undiagnosed. The point that should be remembered is that we'll get to the numbers. Like, well, how many of these cases are we seeing? And don't forget that in the U.S., which has been vaccinating and is further along than Canada, they have given out millions of doses to people under the age of 18.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the age group of people who have gotten 2 doses of the vaccine between the ages of 12 and 17, okay, so under 18 and over 12, because it's only approved for people over 12, after the second dose, in the week after the second dose, which is when we see most cases, the rate is 66.7 events per million doses.
So it's very, very rare.
It's very, very rare. And a way to think about it, if you take out your calculator and you can follow along at home because math is fun, right? 66 divided by 1 million. Make sure you have the right number of zeros.
Yep.
And then multiply by 100 so you get it into a percentage. That's an event rate of 0.006%, which means that more than 99.99% of young men between the ages of 12 to 17 who got vaccinated did not get myocarditis.
Or did not get diagnosed with myocarditis.
Not get diagnosed with myocarditis. Yeah. And even the people who did, I think like 95% of the cases were labeled as mild. The small, most people who presented to hospital went home within a couple of days. And that's the thing. Most cases of this are mild. Like the way to diagnose myocarditis is you're looking for signs of cardiac inflammation. So you're looking for like a blood marker called troponin,
right,
which leaks out of cardiac muscle.
You mean troponin?
Troponin. We call it troponin sometimes. Or in French, tropo. C'est quoi les tropo?
Quoi les tropo?
Or tropes in English, because we're always in a hurry.
Right. Trope stat!
Tropes.
Troponin. Okay. So you look for troponin levels elevated.
So often, like you could have a normally functioning heart. Like you could ultrasound somebody's heart. It looks perfectly normal. But because you have small levels of tropes elevated in the blood, you'd be like, well, that's myocarditis. And if you did an MRI, you might see some signs of inflammation, but it's like, well, what does that mean? Well, maybe nothing.
Is the patient fine? Take some Advil?
Exactly. So most of these cases are very mild, asymptomatic cases that will likely go away on their own. And even if it does happen, it looks like it's very, very rare. So it's not something that would worry me if I was advising people about whether to get vaccinated or not.
I'm comfortable saying it's nothing. There's a little asterisk next to it. This is not a scientific statement, but basically at the end of the day, it's nothing.
Right. It's such as rare. If the risk is real, it's so rare.
It is a testament to our monitoring systems for vaccine adverse events that we are able to pick this up as quickly as we are.
Yeah.
So people want to be reassured as to the safety of these vaccines, you know, these very rare events that you couldn't possibly detect in a clinical trial because we don't have enough people.
No.
We have these systems in place like theirs, like this VSD, and you can detect something that is as insignificant as the risk of myocarditis, pericarditis with the RNA-based vaccines. It's nothing. Let's not talk about geometric means. Let's move on to a bonus thing you wanted to mention very quickly, that we have data on long-term immunity conferred by the COVID vaccines.
Yes, that's right. When we got this email from one of our loyal listeners. Hello, Deb. Hello. Thank you for sending us the email. The question about, is there long-term immunity to COVID? And of course, we've been talking about this. We have data from Pfizer 6 months out showing that their antibody levels stay high. We're probably going to get the one-year follow-up data because remember, the first trials...
Phase one clinical trials.
Yeah, were done like now-ish last year in the summer. So we'll get the one-year data soon to know what people's antibodies levels are at. But antibody levels are not the whole story. A quick immunology lesson. The way you become immune long-term, you have these types of white blood cells called B cells. They are the ones that make antibodies. And so when you get an infection or a vaccine, which is a killed or an activated infection, your B cells, through a very complex process, see that infection, like, oh, we need to make antibodies against this. And some of the B cells become plasma cells that will then make antibodies to fight the infection. And some of the B cells will become memory B cells and will stay in your body for the next time when you become exposed to that infection, and they will be much quicker at making antibodies. So what you want are not plasma cells, but actually memory B cells. The question becomes, when you get vaccinated with the COVID vaccines, do you develop memory B cells or not? And the answer is, well, we didn't know. We were sort of hoping, and every other vaccine works that way, so stands to reason. But now we actually have a proof. And so a lot of the news stories that you probably saw recently were about this paper done in Nature, where researchers took 40-something healthy volunteers, gave them vaccines, and then tested them multiple times over the course of 3 or 4 months out, actually. And what they did was they not only measured antibody levels in their blood, but they also took biopsies, well, needle biopsies from lymph nodes in their underarms. And what they found was they were looking at something called germinal centers, which suggest that these B cells are in fact not turning into plasma cells, but actually maturing and basically going towards becoming memory B cells. I have grossly oversimplified the process. So if friends like Marlena, hey Marlena, are listening to me right now, I do apologize.
Actually,
if she listens to the podcast, which she doesn't, she will be very upset with me. But the basic point is that where this is coming from this observation that when you look at the lymph nodes of people who have been vaccinated, you are seeing signs that the immune response is turning into this long-term immunity, and memory B cells can last for years, if not decades, in the body. So that suggests that we are going to have long-term immunity from COVID.
Now, of course, if a variant were to emerge, right, for which the vaccine doesn't protect us, and we're back to square one, but...
Exactly. So when people talk about boosters, I mean, one possibility was the vaccine stopped working, but the most likely outcome now is that the boosters are not really a booster in the traditional sense. It's not this. It's not dose three of the same vaccine.
It's like the flu vaccine.
It's a different vaccine to reflect a different strain.
Yeah.
So that's probably what's going to happen maybe at some point in 2022. Stay tuned. We'll see.
Because the Global South is not anywhere near getting vaccinated.
No. We can't forget that the planet is round and there's a whole second half to it.
Indeed. So that's going to wrap it up for episode 73. A few announcements. First, as mentioned at the top of our last interview episode, which if you haven't listened to it, was about vaccine patents. We've been talking a lot about vaccines recently. Chris and I are looking for a part-time and paid social media manager for the Body of Evidence. If you feel qualified or if you know someone who would be, head over to bodyofevidence.ca and scroll down the page. You'll see the full description that was posted on June 19th. We will be accepting CVs until the end of July. Also, while you're there, you can click on About at the top of the page. You will see that you can now make a one-time donation to us through PayPal. So if you don't want to contribute on a monthly basis through Patreon, but simply want to make a one-time donation, that is now possible through PayPal. We have tested the system. We have had our first one-time donation.
Exactly. And you know, we recognize that some people just can't do the monthly subscription thing. So that's you know, added flexibility for people who want to help.
Indeed. So you can find that button at bodyofevidence.ca/about. Next month, we will be taking the month off. You, Chris, will be on vacation.
Yes. Well, month off. We always use those vacations loosely. We still keep producing original content.
Yeah, so indeed. So we'll actually release an episode at the beginning of August, and it will be part two of our special episode on medical specialties, where I force Chris to rank different medical specialties from awesome to garbage. And he relates some fun anecdotes about each one. So if you haven't listened to part one, go listen to it now. It was a lot of fun. And then we will be back in September with episode 74. We want to thank our newest patrons, and they are Barb Winterman and Graham Cooper. And a big thank you to Unthor Jonsson for upping their pledge, and to Olivier for the one-time donation. Much appreciated. As always, we want to thank all of our patrons for contributing to the show, and we want to thank all of our patrons at the $5 or more level, and they are Alan, Barb, Bill, Cabe, Chris, DIA, Don, Eric, Frank, Jeff, Helen, Islan, Jankala, Jeff, Juan, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Laura, Leanne, Leon, Louise, Luna, Marianne, Mark, Mary, Mavis, Michael, Mike, Ms. Bean, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Paul, Rena, Ronald, Rye, Sky, Stevie, Suzanne, Tal, That Montreal Guy, Trimian, and Unthor.
If you can come up with a better name for us to do that, please let us know, because we can't think of anything.
So if you want to join these fine folks for as little as $1 a month, head over to patreon.com/thebodyofevidence. Every one of our patrons, even those who contribute $1 a month, they get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. And this month's Digressions will be on...
the philosophical discussion of what makes a disease a disease.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Joseph Hackle. You can find his music at josephhackle.bandcamp.com. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We are on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.